It's Tuesday, October 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Democrats prepare to debate as they vie for the White House in 2016.
We're asking for all states to, first of all, suspend, and specifically the U.S., the arms transfer to all members of the coalition, given that there are war crimes being committed.
An accusation of war crimes in Yemen. Also ahead, the fight to douse Indonesian fires. Ocean food chains may be at great risk. Grateful Dead performances remain alive. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. voters will have their first look at Democratic presidential hopefuls answering and debating questions as they gather later Tuesday in Las Vegas, Nevada. While the Republicans still have a crowded field seeking their party's nomination, the Democrats have just five in the race. Because debates often provide unpredictable moments, there is no sure bet who will emerge as the perceived winner, and the strategies could be surprising as to who will gamble or play it safe in Las Vegas. As VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone tells International Edition host Susan Yockey, this is a very important event for at least the two top candidates.
They're high for all of the candidates involved, particularly for Hillary Clinton, who's been leading the pack. For Bernie Sanders, the surprising surging candidate, the Vermont senator, who has done very well, especially in some early states that vote, like Iowa, and particularly in New Hampshire, where he's leading Hillary Clinton at the moment. And also, there's three other candidates that are going to be in the debate. This is their moment to maybe break through. I'm talking about the former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, the former Virginia Senator Jim Webb, and the former Governor of Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee.
Do you think there will be some tough questioning and talking, or might the candidates be a little easy on each other for the sake of the party in the long run? And after all, they just want to get the White House.
That's actually a good question, because what we've noticed so far is Bernie Sanders has done very well, but there have been no attacks from the Clinton campaign. That's by design. Mm-hmm. They don't want to alienate those Sanders supporters because she'd like to count on them later on, assuming that she becomes the nominee. So will we see a change in strategy in the debate by the Clinton camp, trying to draw more of a contrast with Bernie Sanders, who has described himself as a democratic socialist? And many people who go to his rallies are enthralled by the Sanders candidacy and his focus on the income gap among Americans, the very wealthy and the rest of the population struggling. So it's going to be a test not only for Clinton, but for Sanders. Can he broaden his appeal? And, of course, for the other three in the debate, can they even get on the radar? Because right now the only people mattering who have announced are Clinton and Sanders.
And we have seen the Republicans really going after each other.
We have. You know, this is the first Democratic debate. We've already had a couple on the Republican side. That has had the effect of shooting Donald Trump up to the top spot. But it's also scrambled the race because you have many other people jockeying for position in the Republican field. We have 15 total candidates. One day Jeb Bush is up. The next day he's down. Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson are up. So there's quite a bit of uncertainty on the Republican side. There is uncertainty on the Democratic side, but the players are pretty well known for the moment, primarily Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
Well, Clinton has been trying to clean up her image lately.
Yes, she's, of course, dealing with questions about her trustworthiness, particularly as it relates to how she comes across to voters, but also this controversy over her use of private email account while Secretary of State.
And I noticed she recently brought out the big gun, and that being her husband, the former President Bill Clinton.
Yeah, we're seeing a little bit more of him. I mean, I think for a long time she wanted to make it clear that she's running on her own. She said, I'm not running for a third Bill Clinton term. I'm running for my own first term. She's also said, I'm not running for a third Barack Obama term. And what we've seen of late is her putting some distance between herself and Barack Obama on things like Syria. She's arguing for a no-fly zone in Syria. She would take a more muscular approach in some foreign policy areas. So that may come out in the debate as well. So you could have Hillary Clinton not only drawing distinctions with Bernie Sanders, but with the current president of the United States and her one-time political rival going back to 2008.
Some questions also remain if the Democrats could be jolted by a sudden announcement by Vice President Joe Biden. Some in the party are hoping that Biden will decide to run for president because of two potentially damaging issues facing Hillary Clinton, the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, and her handling of sensitive official emails on a personal server. Both occurred while she served as Secretary of State for President Obama. Well, with all that drama, let's turn to what's buzzing online about the upcoming debate. And as always, our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here in Studio 22 with the latest. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What's the trending hashtag?
Well, the most popular one is hashtag DemDebate, and the Topsy Analytics website shows that hashtag was used in almost 6,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. And like you said earlier, there are only five presidential hopefuls on the Democratic side. And tomorrow's debate will take place in Las Vegas, and the highest polling candidate, of course, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, will be in the middle, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley will be seated next to her. Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee will be on either ends.
Well, let's focus on those two main contenders. Mm-hmm. First of all, what's Clinton saying on Twitter?
Well, she has been tweeting a lot today, and her latest tweet reads like this. As a woman, you're expected to be both strong and vulnerable at the same time. That's not easy to do. That tweet is signed by her name at the end, which means she herself and not a staffer sent out the tweet. She's on Twitter at Hillary Clinton.
Well, gee, she has experience in so many different roles. What does her account description say?
A lot. It says wife, mom, grandma, women and kids advocate, FLOTUS, senator, secretary of state, hair icon, pantsuit aficionado, 2016 presidential candidate. And I just realized those are all in chronological order.
Wow. And definitely all true. Now, what about Sanders?
He has two accounts, both verified. The older account is his senator account, and the handle is at S-E-N Sanders. Now, the tweets are from his staffer unless signed with letter B. The other account is created a year later in 2010, and that's the account he uses for his presidential campaign. And the account's handle is at Bernie Sanders.
So which one do you recommend to our listeners?
Well, it depends on what you want to get out of the tweet. So the first one is more about Bernie Sanders, the man, and what he stands for. And the latter is more on updates on his presidential campaign. So, and the clips, of course, from his tours. Jim?
Well, you'll have two tweets to choose from for Bernie, one, though, for G. Abby Lee, which makes it very simple. Follow her at G. Abby Lee on Twitter. And she tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account as well. You can find that at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
This is VOA's International Edition. Human rights group Amnesty International is accusing the Saudi-led coalition of war crimes in airstrikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen. As Henry Ridgewell reports for VOA from London, the group says hundreds of civilians have been killed in strikes on residential areas.
Amnesty International looked into 13 airstrikes carried out between May and July by the Saudi-led coalition around the northern Houthi stronghold of Sadr. Amnesty's Rasha Mohammed says 100 civilians, including 59 children, were killed.
In one direct airstrike we looked into and visited the site in July, there were a cluster of 9 houses, and there were 4 consecutive airstrikes that were spaced out over 2 hours. 55 people were killed, 35 of which were children under the age of 11.
Amnesty also claims to have found the remains of cluster munitions banned under international treaties. Saudi Arabia did not respond directly to Amnesty's accusations, but has said in the past that it only targets rebel fighters and denies using cluster bombs. Again, Rasha Mohammed of Amnesty.
We're asking for all states to first of all suspend, and specifically the US, the arms transfer to all members of the coalition, given that there are war crimes being committed, and two, for the international community to investigate these war crimes.
The United Nations Human Rights Body issued a report last month detailing alleged violations of international law by all sides in the conflict. Rupert Colville is the body's spokesperson.
The report does not at any point accuse the coalition forces of deliberately targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure, although it does catalogue several specific incidents involving airstrikes that cause large numbers of civilian casualties.
In the 6 months since April, the United Nations says more than 2,350 civilians have been killed in the conflict. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Australia is to send a giant water-bombing aircraft and highly trained advisors to help Indonesia combat forest fires that have covered parts of Southeast Asia in a thick haze. The blazes are caused every year by firms clearing land for palm oil and pulpwood plantations. But the choking pollution from the fires this year is considered some of the worst on record. Indonesia has appealed for international help to contain the outbreaks on Sumatra Island and its territory on Borneo. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Capable of dumping 15,000 litres of water in one go, Australia's firefighting aircraft known as Thor is expected to be battling outbreaks in Indonesia within days. Experts who specialise in extinguishing blazes from the air, from the states of New South Wales and Victoria, two of the world's most fire-prone regions, will also be sent. An advance party of Australian officials arrived in the fire zone at the weekend to prepare for the arrival of the Lockheed Hercules air tanker. Australia has been helping Indonesia tackle the menace of forest fires since the 1990s. Shane Fitzsimmons, the Commissioner for the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, is confident the current deployment will be successful, given Australia's past experience in fire emergencies in other countries.
We've got a track record of demonstrating that whether it's providing assistance to our colleagues in Canada, North America, or indeed places like Africa over recent decades, that professionalism, that approach to national and international standards, I'm confident will see us relatively seamlessly integrate into local operations over there, notwithstanding the normal sorts of logistical challenges that you would expect.
The challenges for fire crews will be immense as outbreaks on Sumatra Island and Borneo continue to burn both above the ground and underneath the peat-rich soil. The haze has made air quality dangerous in parts of Indonesia, Thailand, Singapore and Malaysia, leading to school closures, health warnings and billions of dollars in losses. The fires are also destroying peatlands that are one of the world's most effective carbon sinks, releasing large volumes of climate-changing gases. Greenpeace estimated the Indonesian fires alone could release more carbon dioxide than Britain this year. Singapore and Malaysia are already helping fight the fires in Indonesia, which has also asked Japan and Russia for assistance. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
A new study is warning that the world's fisheries and ocean ecosystems are threatened even more than previously thought by rising carbon dioxide levels. From our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok, VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports that could mean a collapse in the global marine food chain.
After reviewing data from hundreds of published experiments, two Australian professors have concluded that very few marine species will escape the negative effects of increasing carbon dioxide, leading to a species collapse from the top of the food chain down. Ivan Nagelkirchen is an associate professor of the Southern Seas Ecology Labs at the University of Adelaide.
No species is able to sustain itself in an environment where there is not sufficient food. And these effects are only exacerbated as you go up the food chain.
Nagelkirchen tells VOA he and his colleague realized the situation appears much worse than they had anticipated when they first started studying the impact of ocean temperature warming and acidification.
So we didn't expect to see such strong negative responses across so many species in terms of their diversity and abundances.
Previous scientific studies have predicted the collapse of commercial fish stocks within the next 30 years. Even if carbon dioxide emissions are stopped, oceans will still continue to warm and be acidified for quite some time. But there are things humans can do to mitigate the looming disaster.
If we reduce the amount of local stressors, such as pollution of the ocean, eutrophication, overfishing, we can actually buy some time to reduce the number of stressors on these species so they at least get some chance to potentially acclimate to global change.
Results of the University of Adelaide study are being published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
If you thought you've heard the last live performances from the iconic jam group The Grateful Dead, well, think again. Three of the original group members are now teaming with singer John Mayer for a tour called Dead and Company. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the tour came about when Mayer met some of the group members while hosting a talk show.
Last June and July in San Francisco and Chicago, the Grateful Dead played what were billed as their final concerts ever. The sold-out shows came two decades after guitarist and de facto group leader Jerry Garcia died of a heart attack. But now it appears that we might not have seen the last of the Dead. Group members Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and Bill Kreutzmann are teaming with guitarist and singer John Mayer for a new tour called Dead and Company. Mayer has been rehearsing with the group in San Rafael, California. He says the idea came from the way he and some Dead members meshed when he hosted the Late Late Show in February.
Bob and I played on that show and then started to play together up here. And before long, it revealed itself as something that was organic and musical and vital and made sense and really kind of tore down all of the labels and boundaries and stigmas for everybody. And that's what music is supposed to do in the first place. It becomes ultimate truth. Everything goes out the window, and it becomes ultimate truth when we start playing, you know.
Bob Weir says that when he and Mayer played together, there was a communication between the musicians that he wanted to see continue.
And I couldn't help but notice that John was listening to what I was playing. He had learned the songs. I expected that, but he was listening to what I was playing and he was answering that. And it was fun. And it's just so more fun than, you know, that I was really going to be happy about just walking away from. So we got to talking and stuff started rolling.
Percussionist Mickey Hart says that while the show is aimed at the band's diehard fans, the players also get something from performing together again.
Well, it's not just for the fans. It is for the fans, but it's for us, too. Remember, these songs are part of us, and we feel like we want to play them, and we think they're important enough to play. And as long as it feels good and people want to listen to it, want to come to the concerts and bathe in that experience, You can't say no, nor should you.
And for those fans, some of whom paid thousands of dollars to the supposed final shows earlier this year, Mayer says he thinks that they will be glad the band is playing again, despite the cost.
I don't think there's anybody who bought a ticket to go to the Fare Thee Well shows and said, I hope this is really it. I just don't know of any deadhead in the world who said, I just, when I paid my money, I paid to see these guys finish this.
Right.
Trucking, got my chips cashed in, keep trucking.
The band also announced that 5,000 fans will have the chance to win two tickets each to a free November 7th concert at Madison Square Garden in New York. Dead & Company begins its nationwide tour October 29th at the Times Union Center in Albany, New York. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website. That would be voanews.com any time of the day or night. You can also find us on Twitter. We invite you to follow us at @VOA_IE. We always like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, standing tall, Jimmy Cook, and you for joining us today. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In addition to ISIL's atrocities inflicted every day on the Iraqi and Syrian people living in communities the terrorist group has seized, the crucifixions, beheadings, sexual enslavement and violence, rape and denial of every human right, ISIL is also engaged in other crimes, including its attempt to erase cultural heritage that does not conform to its narrow ideology. ISIL's latest reported cultural destruction target is the Arch of Triumph in the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra, a monument thought to be 2,000 years old. It is now added to the list of ISIL's demolition of shrines or statues that predate the founding of Islam, like the Assyrian winged bulls in Nineveh, the historic lions in Raqqa, and the tomb of Jonah in Mosul. What ISIL doesn't destroy of Syria and Iraq's ancient history and heritage, it sells, Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken noted recently at a symposium at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City.
These ancient coins, stone, glass, mosaic fragments, travel organized routes through black markets in the Middle East, Europe, and the Persian Gulf. The profits return to line the pockets of these extremists, funding more savagery, more terror, and more devastation.
It is for this reason the United States has developed red lists with the International Council of Museums to help law enforcement officials recognize looted objects. It's why the U.S. has stepped up efforts through the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL to encourage greater action against the illicit trade. It's why the United States works so closely with international law enforcement agencies in the U.S. and around the world. And it's why the United States recently announced that it is offering, through the State Department's Rewards for Justice program, up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and or the trade of antiquities by, for, or on behalf of ISIL. Calling the refusal to deal in conflict antiquities both a legal and moral obligation, Mr. Blinken said, in the face of the urgent challenges of today, it is critical that we hold fast to the fabric of our humanity, to our gifts of reason and wisdom, our expressions of art and culture, and our universal values of civility, freedom, and dignity. These are exactly what ISIL seeks to destroy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.